student. We have an amazing team of volunteers to welcome you and answer any questions you may have. To donate, you can e-transfer controller at ams.queensu.ca with the subject line AMS Food Bank Donation, or bring non-perishables to our location during the service hours. Also, check out the Pay What You Can Peach Market, providing equal access changing hunger, in the new medical building for fresh soup and entrees on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. For any questions, please reach out to foodbank@ams.queensu.ca.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, Gaza City after the genocide, we speak with our contributor Aboubakar Abed, who reports on his documentation of North Gaza's destruction.
There are still a lot of hopeful people. There are people who have lost their entire families. There are people who have suffered unimaginable losses, but they promised to themselves, we're going to carry that hope with us. We're going to rebuild Gaza.
We hear from the Electronic Intifada's associate editor, Asa Wynn-Stanley, about the recent admission by Israeli officials of the Israeli army using the Hannibal Directive on October 7th, 2023, to shoot and kill Israelis.
The Hannibal Directive was in some ways nothing new on October the 7th, but what really was new was how it was extended from Israeli soldiers to Israeli civilians and the sheer scale that it was used on.
And our contributing editor, John Elmer, brings us the latest resistance report on the Palestinian armed resistance in the West Bank.
Six Israeli soldiers have been killed and 36 have been wounded in 522 qualitative and popular resistance operations in the West Bank in January 2025 alone.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and discussions from our live stream broadcast on February 13th, 2025. Coming up, we explore Gaza City after the genocide with Aboubakar Abed. Later in the show, we'll hear from John Elmer about Palestinian resistance to Israel's Operation Iron Wall in the occupied West Bank. But first, Israel's former defense minister admitted on Israeli television that Israeli troops were ordered to shoot and kill Israeli civilians on October 7th, 2023. Our associate editor, Asa Wynn-Stanley, reports on the order to carry out Israel's so-called Hannibal Directive.
Last week, there was the highest level public Israeli admission about the Hannibal Directive so far, and that was from a 50-minute interview with Yoav Gallant, and it aired on February the 6th on Israel's Channel 12. Yoav Gallant, who was the former defense minister of Israel. Gallant, of course, was Israel's defense minister on October the 7th. He was fired in November last year after falling out with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So we can watch that clip right now.
חוצות את הגדר עם חטופים ישראלים, גם לשאול מה עובר לך בראש, וגם נועל חניבל זה משהו שאתם חושבים עליו באותו רגע?
נועל חניבל, רק נגיד, הנועל שאומר לראות על מנת להרוג כאשר יש רכב עם חטוף ישראלי.
אני רוצה שתבינו שהיכולת של שר ביטחון לתת הוראות אופרטיביות בלוח זמנים שהכל קורה, היא דבר מאוד מוגבל.
ניתנה הוראה לנועל חניבל?
אני חושב שבאופן טקטי, במקומות שונים ניתנה, במקומות אחרים לא ניתנה, וזו בעיה.
What was said there in Hebrew was, first of all, the journalist says, when you see the convoys crossing the border with Israeli hostages, what crosses your mind? Is the Hannibal Directive something you are thinking about at that moment? And then the second journalist chimes in, just to explain, the Hannibal Directive says to shoot to kill when there is a vehicle containing an Israeli hostage. And Yoav Gallant, the former defense minister, says, I want you to understand that the ability of the defense minister to give timely operative instructions when everything is happening is very limited. And then the second journalist, whose name is Amit Sergal, chimes in, was the order given for the Hannibal Directive? And Yoav Gallant replies, I think that tactically, in various places, it was given, and in other places, it was not given, and that is a problem. So, as you heard, like, that was it's a really striking admission there. It was that the Hannibal Directive was used, And it was used, in his words, quote, tactically and in various places. So the Israeli journalist explained what the Hannibal Directive is quite succinctly. Quote, the Hannibal Directive says to shoot to kill when there is a vehicle containing an Israeli hostage, end of quote. So the Hannibal Directive is an Israeli military doctrine which was first established in secret by Israeli generals in 1986. And they were determined to stop Israeli soldiers being captured alive by Lebanese and Palestinian resistance fighters. The capture of Israeli prisoners of war like this has in the past successfully led to prisoner exchanges. And as we've seen illustrated over the past several weeks, these exchanges have led to the successful liberation of hundreds of Palestinians from Israeli jails. The Hannibal Directive effectively says that it's better for these captive Israeli soldiers to be killed by Israel than to be kept alive and in Palestinian hands. And to understand more about the history of the Hannibal Directive, you should read a feature I wrote about it last year titled Israel's National Murder-Suicide Pact. So the Hannibal Directive was in some ways nothing new on October the 7th, but what really was new was how it was extended from Israeli soldiers to Israeli civilians and the sheer scale that it was used on. By now, multiple eyewitness statements and several senior Israeli military sources have confirmed that the Hannibal Directive was used indiscriminately all over the so-called Gaza Envelope region on that day. The key eyewitnesses have included Yasmin Porat, a former Israeli captive who narrowly survived a deliberately calculated Israeli tank shelling of the building where a group of Hamas fighters were holed up with 11 other Israeli captives in Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th. The dead included the 12-year-old Israeli twins Yanai and Liel Hatzroni, whose image was later used in official Israeli propaganda falsely alleging she had been burned to death by Hamas. But in fact, by now we can pretty definitively say she was burned to death by Israeli tank shelling, a Hannibal strike by an Israeli tank fired on the orders of Brigadier General Barak Hiram, who since then has actually been promoted to the head of the Gaza division. The Gallant interview with Channel 12 was significant, this new interview. It was the first time that a contemporary Israeli minister has publicly confirmed the use of the Hannibal Directive on October 7th. So, as you heard in the clip, continuing his sentence where he confirmed that Hannibal had been used tactically in some places, Gallant even clarified that in other places it was not given, and that is a problem. It's unclear from this statement what exactly he considered there to be the problem. Was he actually saying that it was a problem, that Hannibal wasn't applied everywhere, that they didn't kill enough of them? It's a little unclear. It's true that if every single Israeli captured by Palestinians near Gaza had been killed in a Hannibal attack, Hamas would have had no Israeli captives to negotiate with, and there might still have been no ceasefire now. But the Channel 12 journalist didn't press him on this point. And I checked with David Sheen, the journalist who's also one of our Hebrew translators who translated this video for us, and he clarified that immediately after this clip that we just showed, they changed the subject, they moved right on to a different topic. So, you know, if it seemed, the clip seems like it ends a little abruptly, that's how it is in the original.
That was the Electronic Intifada's associate editor, Asa Winstanley. Next up is the Resistance Report. Our contributing editor, John Elmer, brings us details of an operation targeting an Israeli watchtower along Israel's wall in the West Bank, which surrounds and dissects Palestinian land.
We're going to really focus in on the north of the West Bank. The real area of the Israeli attacks are in the triangle, what the British used to call the Triangle of Terror. Jenin, Tulkarm, Nablus, Tubas, even Qalqilya has had mechanized invasions. They're not limited to the north, but they're focused on the north. But we're 3 weeks into Operation Iron Wall, which is an interesting name to choose because that goes back to the roots of Zionism and Zeev Jabotinsky, that the only way the Israelis can exist, that Zionism can exist in the land that is overwhelmingly not Jewish, is to set up an iron wall. In many cases, it's literal. In the beginning, it was called the Tower and Stockade. So it was a base, a wall, and a watchtower. And that is going to be the focus of this operation that I'm going to get into today. UNRWA said that 40,000 Palestinian refugees have been forcibly displaced from the northern West Bank, 20,000 from Jenin camp, 10,500 from Tulkarm camp, 4,000 from Tamun town, which is just south of Tubas, and 400 displaced from Al-Fara camp. And this is the second major operation. It's difficult to even demark these operations because Israel launched Operation Summer Camps, that they called them. The resistance called it the Horror of the Camps. And that battle took place from August into October. And then this Iron Wall operation began right after the ceasefire in Gaza was marked. And since then, there's been more than 77 Palestinians killed since January 1st. The Israeli military says that it's killed 50 fighters in 2 weeks, 35 gunmen, and 15 in drone strikes. But the Iron Wall, again, to go back to that, the stockade and tower is what is going to be the focus of this next operation. I'll just set it up. This is a gunfight between a lone Palestinian fighter who raided an Israeli military position and single-handedly took down 10 of 11 Israeli soldiers. This was in Tassir checkpoint, which was just northeast of Tubas up in the Jordan Valley. So this Palestinian fighter, Mohammed Daragma, he is the brother of an Islamic Jihad commander from the Tubas battalion who was killed a year ago. He carried out this operation, a pretty remarkable operation, to target the tower itself where the soldiers are. And it's very symbolic of the Zionism's way of gaining a foothold in Palestine was through these tower and stockades. And that's what is being hit in this operation. The Palestinian fighter actually made it to the base of the pillbox. This squad, Israeli squad that is guarding this tower is 11 fighters. And the Palestinian fighter who attacked them, there's 8 wounded and 2 killed. So he got 10 out of the 11 fighting 1 on 11. Let me just read you here from the Army radio. This is the IDF's version of the operation, which is all we have because Mohammed Daragma was killed. So a few minutes after 6 a.m., two soldiers leave the pillbox for the nearby checkpoint as part of the dawn alert. The Palestinian ambushed them both at the entrance of the outpost wearing a tactical vest and an M16 rifle with 2 magazines. So he took down the squad with 2 magazines. The IDF estimates that the Palestinians sneaked into the outpost on foot during the night and ambushed the soldiers at first light. The Palestinian charged the 2 Israeli soldiers from very short range, just a few meters, and hit them very hard. At this point, an exchange of fire begins, which lasts many minutes between the Palestinian who is at the entrance of the outpost and the forces inside the outpost, consisting of a squad of 11 soldiers. During the exchange of fire, the Palestinian both entered the outpost and the pillbox, but the IDF emphasizes he did not go up to the top of the pillbox. So it sounds like he was on his way up to the top of the pillbox, if not up to the top of the pillbox, because otherwise, not sure why the Israelis would say, we emphasize that he did not make it up to the top of the pillbox. In any case, he made it back down out of the pillbox and was killed by a backup force that had just arrived. It sounds by this report from the Israelis that he was seconds away from getting away free from this pretty remarkable operation, 11 against 1, and he takes them down. This operation was part of a number of operations that have taken place during this Iron Wall operation. 6 Israeli soldiers have been killed and 36 have been wounded in 522 qualitative and popular resistance operations in the West Bank in January 2025 alone. And they work out over this Iron Wall invasion to be 25 a day of operations, more than half of them armed clashes. So we're seeing the resistance in the West Bank meeting this challenge despite being pushed out of their villages, Tamun, and the refugee camps of Jenin, Al-Fara, and Nur Shams in Tulkarm. And this is just very symbolic for people who aren't familiar with this. These Israeli towers are all over Palestine. They're how they keep guard. They're the watchtowers that are built into the separation wall, the apartheid wall that runs around Palestinian communities. These outposts, these pillbox towers, are at regular intervals all the way through the wall, and that's where they stick their gun out and snipe kids walking to school or just generally wreak havoc as an occupying force from those towers. So they're symbolic historically and they're symbolic today because they're built right into the wall. But this is what's been happening, and the fighters in Tulkarm here want to show us that they have set up a joint operations room that the Qassam Brigade, Saraya al-Quds Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, Youth of Revenge and Liberation is what they're calling the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade faction in there. And they're saying our coordination is sacred, our sacred coordination. And that is an allusion, using the same words, to Mahmoud Abbas, the PA head, who in 2014, in the lead up to the 2014 war, said that security coordination with Israel is sacred and will continue whether we agree with the policy or not. And people at that time in the lead up to the 2014 war were calling for, and have been calling for since the Second Intifada, for the ending of this security coordination where the Palestinian Authority is a collaborator regime that acts on behalf of the Israelis. And Abbas's saying that security coordination was sacred was something that stuck in the craw for quite a long time. And you can see the fighters here playing on that, that our sacred coordination is a joint operations room. So they're setting up joint operations rooms in the same way that Gaza has done that. And this is happening here in the Tulkarm camp. And just one of the, just to give you a sense of what the communiques coming out of Tulkarm sound like, this is Al-Quds Brigade's Tulkarm Battalion the other day. Our fighters in the Tulkarm camp unit, alongside comrades in the resistance factions, successfully ambushed a 20-soldier infantry force at precisely 4 p.m. today. The enemy was attempting to advance and showcase its presence in Tulkarm camp when they were caught in a tight ambush. Our fighters unleashed heavy direct gunfire, achieving confirmed hits. We affirm that the resistance is alive and that our people's will shall never surrender to the dictates of the enemy and its agents, an allusion to the PA. From beneath the ruins of our camps and through the alleys that offer the enemy nothing but death and the might of our heroes, we shall continue to rise. The fighters in the Tulkarm camp, enduring over 15 days of Nazi-like assault, stand firm and reaffirm that the resistance will prevail and that our banner shall never fall. And then this is in Jenin. They released the same type of message in Jenin, that there is a joint operations room that's coordinated with Qassam, Saraya al-Quds, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, with a Quranic verse that says, our soldiers will be the victorious ones. And this is happening in Jenin as well. And Jenin has been ongoing attack on Jenin since summer camp started. It really never ended in Jenin. Before this Iron Wall operation, we'll remember that the PA, Palestinian Authority security forces, had a 48-day siege on the Jenin brigades. The Palestinian Authority were part of the first 10,000 to be driven out of the camp, were driven out by the PA, not by Israel. And then now, in the preceding weeks of this Iron Wall operation, they're operating together, side by side, the PA and the Israelis. Previously, the PA would leave and the Israelis would come in. In Jenin right now, they're operating side by side, and Israel is saying that they intend to stay in Jenin. We'll see how that goes. Abu Ubaidah, when he last spoke, he spoke to note the ceasefire on the 19th of January. He said, we appreciate and salute the heroes of the West Bank for their stance of honor and dignity. A special greeting to Jenin, the sister of Gaza, in courage and defiance. So links between the West Bank and Gaza always in the messaging from both sides. And we're continuing to see that in the northern West Bank. So that is the resistance report for this week.
That was the Electronic Intifada's contributing editor, John Elmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Oh. Our contributor, Abu Bakr Abed, recently traveled by foot from his home in the central town of Deir al-Balah to northern Gaza. He joined our executive director, Ali Abu Nima, and me to discuss his documentation of North Gaza's destruction, as well as the resilience of the Palestinian people.
It's been more than 3 weeks since the Gaza ceasefire and prisoner exchange deal took effect. In that time, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, at least 118 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza by direct Israeli fire, died due to prior injuries, or from the thousands of tons of unexploded Israeli ordnance that litters the territory. Meanwhile, the official death toll, widely considered to be an undercount, has risen to more than 62,000 as people across Gaza return to their shattered communities and find the remains of loved ones whose fate had been unknown. One person who has been traveling across Gaza in recent weeks is Electronic Intifada contributor Abu Bakr Abed, and we're delighted, of course, to have him join us now from Gaza to talk about the current situation.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. So, Abu Bakr, you have been very busy in the last couple of weeks. You have been around Gaza, so let's take a look at some of the reporting you've been doing across Gaza in recent weeks. You've actually been posting video reports at your Twitter account. Let's start with these two short clips, and then we're going to get you to talk about them, and then we'll look at some more. The first one we're going to look at, you filmed in Gaza City's Al Rimal neighborhood. Let's take a look at that.
Just total annihilation. The Holocaust of our time, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Holocaust of our time. If you can't see it, this is the Holocaust of our time. You see what Israel has done to Gaza. Every place has been targeted.
And then we have a second clip that is from Tell el-Hawa, which is also a part of Gaza City.
Now, the civil defense buildings in Gaza have been destroyed, deliberately destroyed, because Israel purposefully wanted to destroy all life aspects inside the territory. Now, for the civil defense, it was really important to find alternatives because the work is very important on the ground. They retrieve bodies from under the rubble. They really help people when bombings happen. And they help the overall population with water and other needed services. So here are the civil defense cars. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cars. This is a part from the building that has also been hit during the genocide. Here is the building. You can probably see that. And here is the civil defense car as well. So it's just, incredibly devastated. People are telling me even to document what has been destroyed inside. But these cars, of course, no longer work. Look, the hole here, this hole is so big.
Tell us more about why you wanted to take these like walking tours of Gaza City and these neighborhoods in particular, and maybe what surprised you the most.
Well, I think because it was really hard to take the pain alone, so I just wanted to vent a bit. That's why, because when I first entered Gaza, it was totally, totally devastated. Like, all the buildings are gutted and I'm gutted at the same time. So you cannot really understand and comprehend the scale of destruction that is seen all across the strip, in every single area, particularly in the northern parts in Jabalia and Safdawi area. Those two areas are completely flattened to the ground. And when you talk about the civil defense, for example, there's nothing military here at all. But I just wanted to show the world that Israel does want only to annihilate every aspect of life and just weaken the social fabric of the Palestinian people. That's their ultimate goal and ultimate aim. And at the same time, like, you walk around Gaza and you have that memory and those good memories of how Gaza was before this genocide. And you feel very heartbroken. Like, I remember this street, for example, under my neighborhood. It was brimming with joy. It was brimming with people's exultation. But all of that has simply vanished. And all the students, like, there were students from every single age, probably from 5 years old, from the first grade until the senior at university. And when you look at it, that there are no students, there is no traffic because it was filled with people and vehicles. And all that you can see is just piles of rubble and piles of garbage because the infrastructure has also been destroyed over the course of the past 14 months. This is truly, truly heartbreaking and insurmountable. And I just wanted to show the world like how it really feels to go around Gaza and to wander around Gaza while Gaza looks like this. Imagine if it is your neighborhood. Imagine if it is your hometown and you come back to it after a year or after 6 months and you find it like this. How would your reaction be? I promise, like, every single, when I return to Deir al-Balah, because Deir al-Balah is not that much devastated. It has seen multiple strikes over the course of the past 15 months, but it's not, it's the least devastated city. We all know that. When you look at Deir al-Balah, there's still a glimmer of hope. But when you look at, like, Gaza, I don't know, like, it's, you cannot really find the words to describe the carnage, the destruction, the unfathomable carnage that, like, people are living, are still very much trapped in that cycle of horror, displacement. It's just the same scenario. People are still carrying water from very far distances. The people are still living over the rubble of their homes, and people didn't know whether the unexploded ordinances are going to explode in their faces or not.
Well, let's look at the next clip we have. It's in Gaza City, I believe, but you didn't say exactly where, so let's run that.
Is this Tell el-Hawa?
That's in Tell el-Hawa.
Yes, it's Tell el-Hawa.
And those are children carrying water.
The two have lost their parents. They're now responsible for the families.
Did you talk to those children? Do you know something about
them? Yeah, I talked to them.
Where are they living? I mean, are they living in a building?
In a tent? No, either in a tent or on the wreckage of their homes. But the wreckage we're talking about is just nothing. Probably one wall standing only of the whole building, of the whole tower. They're, like, Tell el-Hawa is known for its towers, Dr. Ali, you know? There are many towers in Tell el-Hawa where thousands of families, hundreds of families in each tower were living before the war. Now, all of those towers are flattened to the ground, so where people are going to live. There are no ways at all. So people are taking the risk to live inside completely collapsing buildings, and they don't know whether these buildings are going to fall upon their heads or not. This is extremely dangerous and hazardous and something people should be well aware of. That's why Israel is still delaying the entry of caravans and containers into the Strip. That's why people are still suffering and they don't have any life means to protect themselves from the cold, to protect themselves from any possible dangers and or harm. That is absolutely deliberate. This is the modus operandi of the Israelis. That's always been the case. And for me, when you talk about the children, for example, I met a children in Al-Shaja'i neighborhood, not only those two children. Hear from the children of Gaza. Your heart is going to break 1 billion times a day. Like, hear from them. One child we met, her father was killed. She only wears one piece of clothing. It's less than 10 Celsius here in Gaza. How can people cope with such an incredibly difficult situation in the face of this extreme adversity? How can people really cope with it? When you talk about children, this child, this girl, 12 years old child, her father who was killed by the Israeli military, is now taking shelter in a dilapidated, in a completely damp, dank tent in Gaza over the graves. They destroyed the graves in Al-Shaja'i graveyard. And those are graves that we are talking about, which are destroyed. Most of the corpses inside them have been stolen by the Israeli military and they have been smuggled out of the territory. So when we talk about it, it's completely insane. Where are the people who have claimed that human rights are going to ensure or secure people's rights? Like, how can we honor those people who have been killed by the Israeli military? How can we honor all of those deaths if their corpses have been stolen by the Israeli army. And then look at the other children. I mean, a child who stayed the whole time in the north of the Strip, she's absolutely mentally ill. I talked to her, the girl, she's 12 years old, but she's not okay. She doesn't speak well. She doesn't she still has a trauma to recover from. That's why when you speak to the children of Gaza, you're talking about Gaza. What 1.1 million, half of the population is children. Like, what have they got to do with this war? So they were subjected to this level of barbarity. I mean, talk about them. Talk about those children who have been deprived of their education, have been deprived of their childhood. They don't know what childhood means anymore. And then I met three children in Jabalia, and they're saying, they cannot really string two words, I'm sorry, from the trauma. Everything, what happened to you? I ask them, what happened to you? And then they say, my home destroyed like this. And then they started crying and sobbing in pain. How can you tell these children to go? What is the way? I've been asking psychologists from around the world, how can I really, as someone from Gaza, tell these children to cope? How can I really tell them to handle the situation when they don't have a home, when they are taking a responsibility, a very huge responsibility, trying to provide their families with water and food every single day? The free food distribution centers are still operating on the ground. And that is a huge indicator the humanitarian organizations are not honest, are not transparent in distributing aid, despite the fact that aid has been flowing in. It's completely unbearable.
Abu Bakr, it is just seeing the children carrying water and thinking of them, of everything else they're coping, that was just a glimpse of what their lives are like, and what you describe is horrifying. Another aspect you mentioned we're going to see in this next clip.
So I think I found a mine. Yeah, so I'm going to walk away. I'm afraid it might explode. Oh my God, what this sound is.
I believe you were walking towards Gaza City, and it's pretty terrifying that's the Rashid Road, and you saw that mine there. How common is that? It's terrifying to think you could have stepped on it. It could have been live and exploded. Did you walk from Deir al-Balah to Gaza City?
Yeah, I walked 16 kilometers, a trek. Yeah, I walked all the way, and it took me 3 hours, more than 3 hours from Deir al-Balah to Gaza City, and I was totally exhausted after it because it's very, very tiring and it's unbearable, to be honest, to work on foot.
And did you stay in Gaza City?
Yeah, I stayed there 5 days.
Where were you able to stay? Where did you sleep?
I slept in the wreckage of one of my friend's houses. Mm-hmm. And we were shivering with fear every single day, every single night, because, low pressure fronts have been stalking Gaza over the past few weeks.
It's so unbearably cold. These videos that we've seen just over the past couple of days of torrential rain and wind and people's tents who have gone through 16 months now of awful weather. It's unbearable. And all of those supplies are still just a few kilometers away on trucks.
You showed us that landmine, and there was a report yesterday that they said 118 people in total had been killed since the start of the ceasefire. And that included people by direct fire, by unexploded ordnance, and people who died from prior injuries. What are you hearing about the issue of unexploded ordnance, Abu Bakr, and how people are dealing with that?
I think you're right, because this toll includes the people who have succumbed to their injuries because of the lack of supplies. And it also includes, the people who have been killed by those ordinances, and the others who have been killed by direct gunfire and shells by the Israeli military. Now, for that case, I spoke to the father of one of the two cases which were registered at the Gaza Health Ministry, because I've been talking to the Gaza Health Ministry itself as well. And it was Yusuf Kassab. He's 29 years old. And he was on the ceasefire day when it went into effect on the morning of January 19th. He went to see to inspect the carnage of his home in Rafah, and once he went there, he didn't see any landmarks at all, because his home was flattened to the ground and the rubble of his home was even all those away. So he didn't see any landmarks and he really didn't know if his home was there or not. So he went with his neighbor to their home, to their neighbor's home. And when he went there, he got in, he was inspecting also the carnage. He was checking his home, the home of his neighbor. And then he was near one of the kitchen windows. And he just, I could put his hand on one of the, like one of these suspicious devices and it blew up in his face. So his father, whom I was talking to yesterday, he told me like, I came and I saw just half a head and it just saw gashes in his body, many cuts, many deep, deep, deep cuts. And, you know, he the two others with him, his neighbor and the other one, his friend, were also wounded. And yeah, it was a super horrifying scene, not only because of this, because also this man, Yusuf, was a father of three children. And his father told me one of the main obstacles that I'm still trying to iron out or to deal with is that his oldest son, who's 6 years old, keeps crying in the night, asking for his father. And he couldn't say anything. Like, what should I tell him? Like, I mean, like, what should I really tell him? His father has died. And he cannot really take educating those three children, 6, 2.5 years old, and 1 year old. So how can he really educate these children? And those children keep sobbing in pain in search for their father. So this is the tragedy that people are still thinking about. And they told me even we cannot really go back home at all.
I just wanted to say, and you reported on this case and this family for Dropsite News. And according to your reporting and the information you got from the Gaza Health Ministry, at least two people have been killed by unexploded ordnance.
Yeah, and there's another one today,
and about 40 injured. So it's a pretty terrifying aspect of this. So let's talk about some more of your videos. A lot of the videos that you've posted on social media in your trek around Gaza, especially northern Gaza, show immense destruction. But you also show parts of Gaza coming back to life. And so let's take look at these next two clips and get your comment on them. The first one is in Shuja'iyya, which is east of Gaza City. And of course, that's the neighborhood so many of us associate with your beloved teacher, our dear friend, Dr. Rifat al-Ar'ir, who, as we heard from Asim and Nabeel last week, was taken back and buried in Shuja'iyya last week. But let's look at this first clip from Shuja'iyya.
This is Al Shuja'iyya Market, the place, the neighborhood after Al-Saha area. It has also been hit multiple times with the Israeli army over the course of the genocide. But again, people have reopened the markets, have reopened the shops, clothes shops, toys shops, everything. Like, life is being restored here, and everything is incredibly amazing as it was before. Like, there's again, there's nothing seem to be different between the pre-war time and the after-war or the post-war time. There's nothing different, just people are getting back to where they were, and they have that time to relish, to rejoice at the vibrancy and the beauty of Gaza City, despite the overwhelming destruction.
That was in Shuja'iyya, which is east of Gaza City, and then this one is from the Gaza City Gold Market.
This is the gold market in Gaza City, and just gold is being sold here. This is one of the most ancient places also in the entirety of the Gaza Strip. It has been reopened after Israel destructed this area completely, and just a few people are getting through here, get through the streets or walk on the streets to search for gold, because gold is expensive. People don't have money, they have lost their homes, they have lost their jobs. But yes, you can probably see like the gold is really, really amazing and fascinating, but there's also destruction. So this is the end of the gold market in Gaza. And in the background, it's just destruction. You may see that. And this is the gold market.
How typical are those types of scenes? The Shuja'iyya market looked pretty active. People are buying and selling. People's needs don't stop. The gold market there, of course, people may be selling their gold because they need money to live. But
yeah,
as you go around Gaza, what do you see? Do you see shops open? Do you see a lot of business going on? How typical are those clips that we just saw?
Yeah, I think, again, it's just a clear manifestation of people's resilience, of people's love of life. Like when you go back to an area that has been fiercely attacked over the course of the last 14 months, and you see that little vibrancy, that level of love of life, you feel that those people really deserve to live, really deserve everything good in their lives. And those scenes are just a huge indicator, and they just tell the world that whatever you do to Gaza, people cannot really leave it at all. I remember when I was going into a Zawiya market and I found something there, nothing at all. Like, the market before and after the war is the same. There are loads of goods, there are loads of commodities, loads of spices, fruits, snacks, toys, everything, like as if the war didn't happen even. When you see that this is happening after 14 months of horror, and people still have that smile, people are still exchanging smiles and laughs with each other, that can sum it up, that can really wrap it up. And it's just like, you look at people, they're still smiling, and it has finished. We're going to rebuild something. We're so happy. We're going to make it more beautiful than before. And we are just indigenous to this land. We cannot really leave it. Gaza is just our heart. Gaza lives in our heart, and we live in Gaza, so that cannot be split up at all. And the scenes, not even in those places, like, we are seeing this sort of rejuvenation elsewhere, even in Rimal neighborhood, in the University Street, elsewhere. But there is a very deliberate act of trying to erase people's love of life by blocking aid, by blocking the goods, by blocking the commodities. But I've seen at the same time, like when I saw all that destruction, I saw many gardens filled with really plants, like basil, as I told you. I've seen many, there are many green plants over there in many places. People have been planting their small pieces of land to make sure that they will not be devoid of, or their homes will not be devoid of vegetables and fruits. Those scenes are just like the most incredible I've ever seen when I went there, because people are still smiling and still hoping despite all the horror that has been inflicted upon them.
Half a kilometer away in Tell el-Hawa, where you filmed those kids, carrying water, and they've lost everything. They're so traumatized that they can't speak. And then you see the markets full of people going about their daily lives, trying to rebuild. How does that feel inside you? How do you hold both of those things? I can just imagine that probably most people in Gaza are going through this, where they've survived, they want to rebuild, and there's just this individual and collective weight of trauma that will need generations to repair.
Look, the people here are really building their hopes over each other. This is what people, what they have been instilled into. This is what they are really desperate for. And not only this, because I saw many people, I was talking to them, it's normal. I lost my entire family, but I'm going to build, I'm going to marry, I'm going to have kids until we see free Palestine. I promise. This sort of strength is unmatched. This sort of resilience is something I've never seen before. And that's what we wanted from the very first time, that people did not let anyone make them bereft of hope at all. They stuck to it. They really clung on to it, despite it was being dashed every single day by the ongoing policies by the Israelis to wipe out Gaza, to starve them, to freeze them to death, and every sort of death they have been witnessing over the course of the genocide. Again, when you look at the children, how they're playing in the streets, when you look at people, how they are repainting the walls, how they are making, like, they are sweeping up the streets in the most beautiful ways that you cannot really see probably in London or in Chicago, with all due respect to people who live in Chicago, of course. And when you look at that, it's absolutely amazing. You cannot really, 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 I mean, it's wonderful. It's beyond wonderful. From the very first time when I talked to you, I remember at the beginning of the genocide, I told you that there are still a lot of hopeful people. There are people who have lost their entire families. There are people who have suffered unimaginable losses, but they promised to themselves, whether we are going to be killed, we're going to carry that hope with us. Whether we are not going to be killed, we're going to rebuild Gaza. And you see all the banners that are written on the streets, written on the walls, that we promised to rebuild it. They promised, and they are just now implementing their action on the ground. So just give Gaza the time, give them the means, and everything, I promise, everything will be like before and even more beautiful, because I've seen many flowers over there. I've seen how people are smiling. I've seen how they are still going to the beach to relax, despite the scene of the beach is not like before. And this, just all of those views, can give you the clue that Gaza will never be beaten. Whatever Trump says, whatever an occupying power will say, to the very last child, there is hope literally sewed in their hearts. And this is something you cannot clinch at all. This is what I can tell you.
I can just listen to you in awe and not try to understand it, but just listen and observe to what people are doing, because I think it's impossible for any of us who are outside that situation to really understand how people can hold these things together, the daily struggle to survive with this hope. Now, Abu Bakr, we have just one more video clip that I want to show. And you filmed this at the campus of Al-Azhar University in Gaza City. And this is an area where several of the major universities are clustered close together, including the Islamic University of Gaza and Al-Aqsa University. And now we can show a clip.
As far as I remember, where dentistry students attended lectures here, and also medicine students also, their lectures are held here. But look at this, all the laboratories have been hit and targeted. This is Al-Azhar University of Gaza. You can see this is one of the buildings. Utter devastation. There are no words to describe what I'm seeing. This was a yard filled with joy and happiness and vibrancy and activity by students who were always happy, attending classes, gathering to conduct research papers, to conduct research for their studies and meet their professors. But now it's just been turned into a desert.
What did it feel like for you, Abu Bakr, to go back to your campus where you studied, where your friends were, where your hopes were, and to see this must have been one of the hardest things?
It really is. Like, when you look at it, it's become a desert. Even a desert is much better than that. And you see, like, many of plants that grow alone are there, and you can see just like the trees, the computers, the laptops, everything inside the box, and even the benches, the chairs, everything is destroyed. And those buildings have also been hit multiple times by the Israeli army over the course of the past 15 months. So look at them, look how it is looking, like just piles of sand, piles of rubble everywhere. And those buildings cannot really be repaired. They need to be even destroyed again. They need to be destructed and then rebuilt. So this is the level of barbarity that those universities or those educational institutions have been hit without any reason. So there is nothing, there is no justification of those ongoing, of those war crimes against people. But again, I know many of those people who love, because this is the yard of the campus at this university, Al-Azhar University, and I know many of those students who were absolutely decorating those buildings in this yard were killed. And I know many of them, and like I remember very vividly many of those people who were studying dentistry, who were studying medicine as well. They were killed by Israel. Many of those students, when we talk about the death toll among students, among university students, it's over 2,000, 3,000, I guess, students who have been killed from different universities in Gaza. And all of those universities have just are now a wasteland. They are wastelands, and they cannot really be used to resume education. It's very difficult to see that your university is like this. And what makes it very difficult, because when I was walking around, I was thinking about the academics who were justifying Israel's genocide. And I really remembered that Jewish Zionist university professor at Columbia University when he was justifying Israel's war crimes. So what would his reaction be like if this were his university? What would it be like when the university professors who were justifying and giving consent for the Israelis to hit universities, what would the reaction be like? What would it be like for all those workers in the academic field would be like? It's just insane. Everywhere I went across this universe, everywhere like I went here, I was thinking about the same thing. Imagine, like, I haven't completed my education. It's been almost a year and a half, and I cannot really complete my education. My colleagues have been killed. My university professors have been killed, like many of them, not all of them, but many of them. And all the lecture rooms where we hanging out, where we discussing things together, discussing the lectures, all of them have been bombed. I'm asking myself all the time, like, why? But if this were an Israeli person, a student, or if this were a Ukrainian student, look how the world would react and look how the world would erupt. What feelings you have. Sometimes, I'm sorry to say this, but sometimes when I wanted to film something, I had to turn off my heart because the pain, I cannot really take so much pain. Like, I've really gone around so much. I've really spent kilometers and long hours walking around Gaza to film all these things. All the lovely places that I used to visit are no longer there. All the memories that I made have been buried under the rubble, and they are no longer on my mind because of what I've seen. And all of the friends, many of the friends that I used to be at with are now in graves inside the graves of Gaza. And the others have been living outside Gaza or have escaped for safety. Look, like our memories lost, our dreams crushed, our universities destroyed, our life paths have been smudged by the Israeli military. You think about it, like, why? Why a restaurant was hit? Why a cafe was hit? Was there anything necessary to flatten a cafe? Was anything necessary? Was there a reason to destroy or to demolish a restaurant or a university or a library or a bookshop? Even the bookshop, Samir Mansour, which is the, I think you know it, Dr. Ali, which is the most famous bookshop in Palestine, not even in Gaza, it was also severely hit and destroyed by the Israeli occupation over the course of the genocide. And then you look at it, it was a newly built and people would loved going to it. People loved spending time there reading books and reading novels. Nothing. Israel has left nothing. Nothing has really been spared by Israeli attacks. This trauma, I think, is untreatable. And I think no one can really treat this trauma. No medications, no psychologists, and no one, because we need to build it. We don't need only to build new buildings. We need to build new memories until we really rehabilitate and recover from what we've been through.
And as you say, Abu Bakr, so many professors, so many students, your own friends, I know many that you've lost many friends, as everyone in Gaza has, the people you had your best memories with in university, you carry them with you, and you and your other classmates carry them with you. And we all hope and believe that you all still have bright futures ahead of you despite this. We know what you're made of, and we know what you bring to this world. And I have a lot of belief in all of you as a generation, some of the finest young people in the world that I've had the privilege to get to know throughout this horrific genocide, but also in the last years, you know, the young, the writers we work with at the Electronic Intifada, many of you were students of Dr. Rifat, and you are just a generation of tremendous promise, even so today, and I have a lot of faith in that.
I made many problems to make this interview because everyone is asleep. Look, Deir el-Balah, what is Deir el-Balah known for is first, it sleeps very early, it wakes up very early, so people normally wake up or get up like before the dawn, like 3 a.m. in the morning, and that's a time no one in the world gets up at. And they sleep very early, like when the sun leaves Deir el-Balah and the sunset comes, everyone gets to sleep, so it gets dark. And no one can really get out. You can see probably dogs and cats outside, but you cannot see people at all. And just like this, because the most vast majority of people here in Deir el-Balah are farmers, and they have to go to their work very early in the morning. But what makes Deir el-Balah special is, if you throw a needle, you can hear a sound. This is how it is, to be honest. It's very calm. Probably the calmest city in the world, believe me. That's what I love about it. And even some of the, like when people return to the north of the strip, some people from Gaza and elsewhere who know Deir el-Balah told me, I'm sure you are so happy about the return of people because you're now in Deir el-Balah, the original Deir el-Balah. And I said, no, they're welcome at any time. Yeah, Deir el-Balah is a very beautiful city. It's known for its palm trees. It's normally taking the red color because of the palm and of the dates. And it's very calm, like you cannot really find people. So that's how it is. That's why Deir el-Balah is special.
Very special. And it's incredible. and it's your city, which also makes it very special. Abu Bakr, thank you so much for this incredible tour of Gaza and talking about so many difficult things that you have witnessed and are still experiencing. But we're so grateful for that you share them with us and you share them with the world. And we just showed a few clips of the videos that you've been posting. There are others. And of course, we only showed bits of the videos. So people can find all your videos at your Twitter account or X account, x.com/AbuBakr Abed W. And we hope you'll come back very soon.
Again, like we're very hopeful. And we're showing that hope, inshallah. We're going to show you from now on how Gaza is looking by our hands, by our building hands, because we're going to rebuild, we're going to do something. And by the way, we have some plants there that have grown, other than like the yellow rose, unfortunately, has not even bloomed again because it's not the time for it. But there is the yasmin, and there is there are the other plants like kubeza. And the beauty is there. Everything is there. We're going to hold on to it. And I think I have to leave because everyone is waiting for me to end this one. They're going to kill me. They're asleep.
Bye. Thank you, Abu Bakr.
Abu Bakr, you're the best.
We'll see you very soon. Thank you.
Such a character.
That was Abu Bakr Abed in Deir el-Balah. Thank you for tuning in to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. Music by Greg Wilson.
Hey CFRC listeners, in celebration of International Women's Day, local icon Miss Emily and the Kingston Music Office are hosting an International Women's Day showcase on March 7th at the Broom Factory, with support from your friends here at CFRC. Experience a showcase celebrating the remarkable talents of women and non-binary artists in the Kingston community. Miss Emily will be hosting the night with feature performances from Clara Smallman, Julia Finnegan, Kyra Daniel, and Savannah Shea. Stay for the fireside chat exploring songwriting, creativity, and the challenges of navigating the music industry as underrepresented voices, as well as a showcase of women-led businesses in the Kingston community. It's sure to be the event of the season. Doors are at 7 p.m., and tickets can be found at ticketscene.ca.
Bruce Kuwabara, celebrated Canadian architect and the mind behind Agnes Reimagine, the new home of the Agnes Etherington Art Center, is this year's Francis K. Smith Lecturer in Canadian Art. In his talk, Catalyzing Change, Kuwabara presents several recent projects that explore the themes of art and community and the insights he gained working on Agnes Reimagined. Join us on Thursday, March 20th at 6 p.m. in Grant Hall for this exciting event. Tickets are free, but please register by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
I'm still...